This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
Hi, Vietnamese Podcast. My name is Carolyn Nguyen, and I'm the debut author of The Fortunes of Jaded Women.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world.
Thank you for coming on, Carolyn. What does it mean to be Vietnamese to you nowadays?
I feel like Vietnamese people are very funny, and a lot of my book and my work highlights that because, we like to roast and drag each other quite a bit, and we have that resiliency and like thick skin to like handle that type of like dialogue and insults, right?
Congratulations on getting this book published, because I know that's a big deal. It's very difficult to get, you know, to finish something and then finally to get it published and put out there. So that's a big feat. So congratulations.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much. Yeah, it's definitely been a journey and a half to get here for sure. My undergrad degree was in journalism, but it took me 10 plus years to really get like a book together. This is probably like the third book I've written, and the other two were like completely shelved. But this is the one that like really came from my heart. And like, I've always written about Vietnamese American stories, you know, but in like 5 years ago, this book would never have been made. Right. So the fact that like, this was like able to like reach, you know, this like national level of attention and like from a major imprint and publishing house, it's quite joyful.
Well, why do you think 5 years ago it wasn't a thing, and then now today was able to be picked up?
You know, I was just talking about this with some friends, but like, it's kind of trendy to be Vietnamese now. Like, I don't know if you like feel that way too, but like, I feel like more and more Vietnamese stories that's not about the war is like finally coming to light. And yeah, it's like this like strange like trendiness of being Vietnamese. Like, I never saw it being trendy. we're just kind of like, it's just who we are, right? It's our lived views, like it's our reality. So I'm like the exception, not the rule in publishing. My agent at the time was Korean American. My editor behind the book is Vietnamese American. So, you know, to have those people behind the scenes who really would usher in these type of stories is so crucial, right? Like to have a Vietnamese American editor acquire and buy my book and edit the book, it goes so far. And it shows, like, look at the reception, right? Like, it's important to have these people behind the scenes too.
That's probably the answer I wasn't thinking of, which is 5 years ago, 10 years ago, people behind the scenes, like your editor, were not put in place, or we didn't pursue those kind of careers. So we just didn't, you know, we just weren't in the control booth helping out writers and creatives that were on their journey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like now there's more of us, right? There's more of us in these positions. And, you know, I can only hope in like 10 plus more years, like hopefully sooner, that there'll be more people, more Vietnamese people in like higher positions of power to like make those like executive calls.
But how lucky are you to have a Vietnamese editor, a Vietnamese woman editor, to understand what she's, I mean, can you tell me a little bit about that interaction and that experience? I mean, was that somebody you were looking for? Did you know the person, or it just happened to be?
I did not know Lone, but I knew of her book. She is a YA author as well, young adult. And so she wrote a story called A Pho Love Story. So I did know of her, but never in a million years would I ever expect for her and I to cross paths. because, you know, when you write this, when I set out to write this book, like, I kind of assume that, like, nobody but Vietnamese would be behind the scenes. Like, that's just, like, your natural assumption, right? Like you just, like, could never dare to hope. But then my agent at the time, Stephanie Kim, she found Loan and her wish list of books. And she's like, we have to go for Loan. We have to try for Loan. And, you know, Atria is, like, such, like, a... Atria, the imprint, is, like, so, like, big. And it's just so, I never dreamed I would get Atria or Loan. And so we really wanted to get Loan. And so it all worked out at the end. Yeah, it's very lucky. It's extraordinarily lucky. And I only hope to be able to have that same luck again for, like, my next couple of books.
Yeah, because the book is really centered around Vietnamese women. And then how appropriate mm-hmm. to have a Vietnamese woman editor on the other side to really have that kind of support is phenomenal.
You know, what's interesting about that, because the book is based off a Vietnamese sidekick in Hawaii who's very much real. Loan's mother actually knew of the sidekick I was talking about in the book. So that just shows another power of, like, community, right? And, like, word of mouth in the community where, like, you know, Loan grew up on the East Coast, right? And her mother knew the woman in Hawaii.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I wanted to lead in with, is this psychic from Hawaii.
Yeah. Everybody I've talked to, they always ask me, what is her name and how can I get how can I go see her? It's so funny. She's very real. She's like, I guess I can tell her name. Her name is Lanbo. She is on the island of Oahu. And yeah, I think she's like she's off some freeway, but you can just look her up, Lanbo. And yeah, this woman has been haunting Oahu for forever, for like decades.
Yeah, I have a very close, my partner and friend is Anderson Lay, and he's from Oahu. And he's told me about this psychic for many years. And we're just, I've always wanted to go and see her. But yeah, I've known about her for many years. Yeah.
And you know, the real deal is such an interesting way, because did your family grow up like very superstitious? And like,
yes.
Did you have like a family fortune teller, right?
Yes, we still engage in that sort of practice, yes.
So it's interesting that you know, we talk about like what the real deal is, right? And like, you know, my family also has like fortune tellers and like numerologists, and my dad has a woman in Vietnam he sends numbers off to, right? But the funny thing is about all this stuff growing up, it's like it never came true, right? Like it literally never came true. And so that's why I always took it like a grain of salt, because, you know, I think when I was like a child, my mom like took me to see somebody to see like what I would turn out, like what my profession would be. And they said I'd become a surgeon, and like, thank God I didn't become a surgeon, right? Like I would have killed so many people. Like I should not be a surgeon. And so that's why it's interesting when I heard about Lanbo. I heard about Lanbo through my friend's mother or something crazy like that. And then they talked about how you have to go see Lan, like you have to go see Lan. And so then when I flew to see her for my, I think it was like 27, for my 27th birthday at the time. And yeah, like I will never see her again. That's for sure.
Why?
Yeah, because I think it was like just so like, there's something very powerful to see a Vietnamese woman like that, who is like such a larger than life figure in the community, right? And, you know, like, I just remember feeling like sitting there and like listening to her talk, and she knew stuff about my life that nobody should know. You know, like she knew stuff that like only my mother knows, or like, you know, it's very like intense stuff that's like deep family history, like really crazy. And I just remember thinking like, I should not be here. Mm-hmm. So I flew to Lanbo for my 27th birthday, like 5 years ago. So you can guess my age if you want. And I saw her because I was kind of going through like a hard time at the time, like of my period, at the period of my life, and I just wanted like, it's something so comforting to talk to another Vietnamese woman, and I had heard so much about this woman, and I just wanted to see if she was like the real deal versus like maybe like the family fortune tellers my parents saw or like the numerologist my parents saw. But when I went in there, like, and I like sat across from her. And by the way, it took me 7 hours to see this woman. You cannot, it's like walking into a mortar. You simply cannot walk into a mortar, right? Like you need like an appointment time. If you do not have one, you have to wait for a very long time to see her. She is like booked back to back to back to back. But my friend Dana and I, we like waited to see this woman. And then when it was finally my turn, I like sat down across from her and she like said stuff that like nobody should know. Like she knew stuff about my family, my life. That was like, so like, it's like stuff you take to the grave. Right. And so that's why I was like really freaked out. I was like, oh, and I had this feeling, I don't know if I should be here. Right. Because I've never experienced that with like anybody else my family has spoken to. All the fortune tellers, all the numerologists, like I didn't have the exact same feeling that I had of like just like chills. And it was just so crazy. And then she, at the time I had given up writing, right? I wasn't gonna make it as a writer. And so I had to like just like pivot. I went into tech. Like I had been trying for so long and I just wanted to like kind of give up. And so I kind of like took a long break in my writing career. And, you know, she looked at me and she said, you know, by the time you're 33, like, you're going to be very successful. You're going to have like a book come out. And then she told me when I would meet my agent, she said, your agent will look just like you. And she meant that she was like an Asian woman. Right. And then she predicted when I would meet, when Lone Lee would acquire the timeline in which she would acquire my manuscript, because Lone actually rejected my manuscript the first time. And she said that. She said, not the first time of Lone, the second time. Obviously, she didn't say Lone's name. That would be too crazy, right? Yeah. But she said, like, not the first time, the second time. And so when we went back out to Lone again the second time, that's when she acquired the book. It's freaky. Like, I'm telling you, like, if you speak good Vietnamese, like, you should go see this woman for sure.
I really want to go see it because I'm into that kind of stuff. I really am.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, it's very interesting. And it's quite powerful to see, like, this woman who immigrated to Oahu in the 70s, like, have this presence in the island, right? Yeah, like, she is a staple of the community and everybody knows who she is. They call her auntie. It's the same in my book. I call her auntie in the book, right? Like, yeah, maybe I'll go see her again one day when I'm, like, not afraid anymore.
Yeah. You call her Auntie He, right?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't want to call her by her real name in the book.
But why did you name her that?
Like, grab random names. Yeah. Like, names I have heard, like, throughout my life. Yeah. Like, the surname Jung is my mother's surname.
Got it.
You know, so I use that for the women, you know. And it's like names. I wanted names that you don't typically see of Vietnamese stories. Like in the book.
Yeah, because Auntie Hua, it sounds to me like it's, well, the way it reads is Auntie Promise.
Oh, that was totally intentional. let's just say it's intentional, okay? Let's just say my Vietnamese is that good that I was able to have that, like, that moment of clarity. Yeah, over 30.
But isn't that weird? You just named...
That is weird.
It's H-U-A with the right, you know, marks that says, this is promise. So it's weird.
Wow. Oh my gosh. I'm a bastion of Vietnamese literature.
But it makes me think about, like, you know, when we pull ideas from the ether, you know, you're sitting and writing and things come down. These are one of those examples where you kind of, I don't know, maybe I'm reading too much into things sometimes, but I feel like writers always say that they're not really in control sometimes. They're just pulling thoughts down and it just gets channeled through their fingers. Do you experience that?
Yes. When I wrote this book, so The first draft took me 5 years to write. When Lone rejected me the first time, she gave some feedback, and it was originally like a series of like short story collection. It's a short story collection, right? And when Lone gave me feedback, I could see everything. It was like a strange out-of-body experience where like I could see what she was trying, like I could see what she wanted from the book, and I could see like what I had to do. And so for 2 months, I like sat down on my computer, like after work, before work, during lunch, and I had an extreme out-of-body experience, and I like just like began to revise it. Like stuff just like flew out of me.
That's crazy.
Like, and I knew this was the book that, this was the book that like Lambeau was talking about. You know, like you just kind of like know, you just know. And it took me like, I've been writing my entire life, right? High school, college, grad school. Like I didn't have that same experience like I did with this book, where like in my mind, I always knew how the book was going to end. I always knew the last sentence, and I just like knew.
In one of these interviews recently, you said that your work in journalism was something that you pursued for a long time. And you never made it. And I found that to be an interesting statement, a very honest statement. But what do you mean you haven't made it? Because I feel like in journalism and the arts and creative pursuits, it's all about just like staying with it for a long time until something happens. But for you to say very concretely that I didn't make it, what can you talk about that journey of perhaps not making it? What does that mean?
Yeah, you know, I got a journalism degree in college. I do not advise it at all. But back then I was like, I'm going to be a journalist and travel the world and, you know, write these like hard hitting investigative pieces. And, you know, after I couldn't land a job. I just could not do it. And so then it took me a couple of years. I didn't do it. I wrote some small pieces. It again, very freelance, not stable. And then I got like this writing manager who, you know, wanted me to move to LA and like write a couple of screenplays and pilots to see like how I can like pivot to like that type of like format, right? And I was like, okay, I'll take a shot, even though like, you know, again, it's not paid. You're just kind of taking a chance. And, you know, I think I was like 23, 24 at the time. And I was living in East Hollywood. I remember this. I was living in East Hollywood in a hallway closet that the guy was renting for $300 a month with no windows. And I remember thinking like, I'm not going to make it. Like, I'm just not going to make it because I need to eat. I need a paycheck. Like, I just need to live. And so by the time I was 24, 25, I just abandoned it all. Like I just like stopped trying. And I moved to Portland for like a coding boot camp, and I just like went into tech. Yeah, because I knew in my heart back then, I was like, this is not the time for me. Like it's time to call it quits, or I keep doing this for 5 more years and then I'm 30 and then I'm just gonna like just keep grinding, you know? And like some days I just wanted to have a stable paycheck. And like, I just knew that, yeah. And that, like that one summer I knew.
It's so crazy listening to these kind of stories of people who struggle in their early years trying to find the voice of the craft.
Yeah.
And, you know, but I'm curious. I mean, spending $300 in a hallway closet, what did you do for money? And what did mentally, how did you kind of get to coding?
You know, I'm like always online. I'm like a little like a little mole, just like digging for information. And at the time, like at 24, like coding boot camps were very like trendy, right? Like everyone's like, oh, like make money as a software engineer. Like it's so easy, just complete this boot camp. And I like fell for it. Yeah, I actually was just talking about this with my friend who also went with me to Portland. And yeah, I mean, I got a job after. I think my first job in tech paid like $45,000 a year as like a web developer. And that was the most money I've ever made in my entire life, by the way, at like 25. And so I was like hyped on life, right? I was like, oh my God, I'm rich. This is it. This is it, Carolyn. Right. And then I quickly realized it's actually quite difficult. Yeah, it's actually really hard. And I did it for like 2 years, but like it was like I suffered. And like whatever code I put out there, it's weak. I'm sure it will dismantle the entire infrastructure. I don't know what happened. But then I went to grad school because like in like the similar like web development, UX, design, stuff like that. I was like, okay, well, if I can't cut it as a program, I'll just do this. And so it's a very long story, but I just pivoted into tech afterwards. But the entire time I was doing that, I could not let it go. You just can't let it go.
Wow.
And yeah, you can't let, I've always known my entire life, like I wanted to be a writer because I remember when I was a child, like I would have such intense dreams of being a writer. Yeah, it was so strange. And like, so I had to keep writing.
I now it all makes sense because I was reading it and the book, and I was thinking to myself, this is like some 50-year-old lady who's traveled extensively, who's lived a lot of life, is writing about her experiences. And I mean, because you're taking us to Hawaii, New York, Saigon, Orange County, Seattle. You're writing about Priscilla and Mark, in the, these, whatever names that you've given these characters was, for me, I got it right away. It was like, oh, you spent some time up in the tech area, tech space. So in my mind, I was like, you're much older, but now I get it. Like, and these weird times in our lives happen when you look back and that Steve Jobs thing where the dots all connect and the reasons why you took off and lived in, but unbeknownst to you or to any human, these things kind of come back up in the creative world, the creative process.
They do, yeah. They always kind of like sneak up on you, right? Like you just like I look back and I'm like, I'm so glad I walked away at 24. Like I'm so glad I chose a different life
Yeah.
back then because now I can see with so much clarity. Like it's okay to quit, actually. It's okay to just give up for a little bit or even a long time or even forever. Because if your mind's really truly cannot let that go, it'll come back to
Come back,
you.
yeah.
Yeah. It's quiet for a couple of years, but it's back there. Yeah.
Yeah. Now,
Yeah.
while you're in tech and you're coding and you're doing all of this work, how did you get back into your rhythm of writing?
So I lived in Seattle for almost like 10 years, on and off again, on and off again. And I, at nighttime after work, I'd be like, God, like I just need something, right? And so I took 5 years, almost 4 years of classes at the Richard Hugo House in Seattle, which is like a writing center. And I wrote a short story based off of Lanbo in the Richard Hugo House. And then my teacher at the time, Ransi Young Cho, a Korean queer man, he read it and we got coffee one day and he's like, you need to keep writing. Like you just need to keep going. Like whatever you do, you just gotta keep going. And I was like, really? And he's like, yeah, like you must keep going. And then I never saw him again because he moved to LA afterwards. And I just saw him for the first time in 5 years at my Los Angeles debut of The Fortunes of Jaded Woman. And I was like, oh my God, Ramsey,
Wow.
like that coffee meeting, like I kept going after that. Yeah, and writing and most creative work is very lonely. You don't know what you just don't get any confirmation, validation, or enthusiasm most of the time. It's just so lonely, right? Like you're just in your own head. That's it. And you have no idea what you're doing is good or bad, mediocre, like problematic, right? You have no idea, right? And then to have those tiny blips or like people say like this keep going, that can go like a long way for a lot of people in this industry.
Yeah. And the sheer amount of people, creatives that are just kind of quietly doing their work is a, there's a lot. And to finally finish something, it's not like a year or two where you just kind of like bang it out and, you know, it's like out there. These things for me, it's like a minimum always of like, you know, percolating in your brain, you know, a few years and finally getting to write it, a few years. All in all, typically it takes about 10 years to, roughly about 10 years to, from start to finish for any of these first debut novels. What do you think drove you to finish and to keep pushing?
You know, I have to say I'm quite an introvert, but you know, I had like a large community in Seattle. And so, you know, from work, school, friends, you know, my neighborhood, like I was always like out and about, and I just didn't give time to myself anymore to allow myself to dream about really being an author again. But when the pandemic hit, that silence, like, while it was so awful for so many people, that silence allowed me to think and breathe again. Like, I was able to see things so much, like, just, it was so clear to me to know, like, what I truly wanted from this life, to be, like, just happy, like, writing, like, in my own world. And that time period, while a lot of people, like, in, you know, like, it was just so tumultuous and so bad for a lot of people. But for me, it was, like, my little woman cave of producing the most creative work of my life.
You know, a lot of people don't talk about it because I think it's kind of like, people feel like a lot of people, you know, a lot of people died, a lot of people suffered. But what's not spoken often about is the amount of creative work that was completed. As I sit and interview all these artists and writers, I've learned that in those 2 years of the pandemic, it allowed so many people the freedom to pursue. I mean, for me too, I thought about podcasting for a decade before I even got started. And then, you know, I think that was the impetus for me to say, all right, this is one life to live. We got to go for this. And we just do it. And here we are. Yeah.
I feel a lot of people have like a come to Jesus moment, right? Of like, what do I want with my life? Like, what do I want to do? Like, if you have all this time to think, like, how do you want to spend that time doing? Like, you know what I mean? Like, it was just so, it was, it was a good time period for me personally in writing Fortunes of Jaded Women.
You know, in one of your Instagram posts, you wrote something, I'm paraphrasing here, but you said something about, thank you for not judging me for making terrible life choices. I thought that was really funny, but now I'm seeing who you are. You're very funny, but it's like an understated kind of humor. But I wanted to ask you, were you being funny or did you really make some bad life choices that we can talk about?
Oh yeah, no, yeah, my 20s were a mess. Yeah, no, I, like the hallway closet, like, you know, I made some horrible like decisions with like love and relationships, and you know, I think I was just like, you know, in your 20s, like, you think you're so invincible. So every decision you make, you feel like nothing, no consequences can come from it. A lot of consequences can come from the decisions you make in your 20s, for sure. Yeah, I'm still paying for some in my 30s, right? Like, and so it's always like whatever you think, like, and some decade is so messy. Was so messy, right? And so I really wanted to highlight that in the book with the women, because the women are so messy and I love that. And like, they make horrible decisions and they never learn from their mistakes, but they keep going, right? And it's like, they keep hitting that wall. And I just love, I really, this is a really weird thing for me to say, but I really love it when people don't take people's advice, even though they keep hearing the same advice over and over again, because that shows a type of stubbornness and determination, right? So I always like think that's like really funny to me, where like you get such great advice and like, oh, like, why don't you try it this way? And they're like, I don't know, I'm gonna keep doing it my way until my life blows up, you know? And so, yeah, I just love that kind of like mentality. I just think it's like so funny.
But what are the terrible decisions? Some of the terrible decisions that you said you... I'm like, I'm here for that. I'm like,
Oh my God.
what kind of terrible life choices would make somebody say, I made some terrible life choices? I mean, you're here, you're successful, but what were the things that were so
No,
terrible?
it took me a real long time to get to this point. And I don't know, I'm just like a messy person. I think I was like seeking love in place I didn't know how to get that type of love that I thought I needed. You know what I mean? And that's why you grow up and my parents never said I love you, right? They don't say that. And so I didn't know, I thought I needed to hear those words from people, places and things to feel fully assimilated, right? And so that's why a lot of the love stories in the book is just making really terrible relationship love advice. The Mark and Priscilla storyline, because I worked in tech as an Asian woman, I named it after Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan, right? Because I saw so many of those type of relationships in my co in all the companies I worked at, and so it's just so messy, right? And everyone's like looking for love and to feel validated. And I'm not gonna tell you any of my stories, Kenneth.
You know, I'm like digging
So
for it.
don't
You know, I'm
try.
like,
Don't try to squeeze out of me.
look,
You need
I give it one hard college attempt, and then I back out because sometimes I'm, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I know. I You're trying to dig and fish and claw your way. I'm a vault. I'm not saying anything. That only Lambo and I will know what happens.
Thank you for locking the vault up, because I think the struggle is fun too, right? This dialogue, this banter, trying to break into that, you know, vault of like, okay, tell me about the terrible decisions, you know. And I'm trying to be professional about it, but all right, we're past that now. Very cool. As you're getting out of this coding mentality, and you're writing more because you're connected to this, just this center of writing. It's not a college or anything. It's just a writing center.
It's a writing center in Seattle. It's like a local. It's very famous, but it's like popular in our community in Seattle. And so the Richard Hugo House really helped me craft my fiction skills, and I actually applied for my MFA program. Yeah, so I got into MFA program, and I was, you know what, the week I started was the week I got my literary agent. So I dropped out because I signed with an agent, and never in my life would I think I would have gotten an agent to offer to represent me.
But you didn't finish anything yet when you got an agent? Like, did you have a manuscript finished?
I had a manuscript, yeah. I had a short story collection, which is the original bones of The Fortunes of Jaded Woman.
Wow. And how quickly your life changed after getting an agent?
It probably I signed with her in December or November or October. I really can't remember. This was like in 2020 or like yeah, it's probably 2020. And then we went out with loan. I would say it changed in like 4 to 5 months. Yeah, quite drastically. I remember I had pulled a pandemic panic move, and I had packed up my entire car in Seattle, and I was set to drive down the I-5 and move back to California, because I said to myself, I don't want to die in Seattle. I want to be close to my family. You know what I mean? I was like, I can't die here. I don't want to die in Seattle. I had lived there for 10 years. I was like, I really miss my life here. I miss And so I remember my two friends, my friends from high school, Catherine Tran, her husband came up and they helped me drive, you know, my car. My car is like so shitty. It's like a two-door hatchback Toyota Yaris with like dents on the side. And we drove my entire life along with like my rabbit in the back seat. It's a hatchback, right? So there's like three of us and a rabbit and three people inside a hatchback. And at four, six, 6 o'clock, 6 o'clock in the morning, East Coast time, my agent calls me and she's like, loan offered. And we were literally driving past Portland when she called me at 6 a.m. And I was like screaming in the car. Everybody was like screaming with me. My rabbit was screaming. We were all screaming together, just like we couldn't believe it. Yeah. And I was just heading down the freeway to move back home.
How long ago was that?
This was probably February of 2021, I think.
God, it was just
Yeah.
recently.
Yeah.
It's just like
Isn't that crazy?
yesterday.
Isn't that crazy? Yeah.
And then you had 2 months to reorganize the.
I had probably, I don't remember now, probably 4 months to revise and edit and everything. And then, yeah, just resubmitted back to loan. And we went through the whole publication journey. And it takes a long time in publishing. But yeah, and then I got Good Morning America Book Club, Book of the Month, Amazon Pick, like BuzzFeed, Bustle. I couldn't believe it, right? Like, I just simply could not believe it.
Yeah, because
Because, yeah,
it
yeah.
just, yeah, what you think about your life where it's such a dark struggle for a decade or decade and a half, and you know, it just takes a year and then things just really turn around. And we just
Yeah.
never know. But see, that's why our parents are so afraid of us taking these routes into art and music and writing, because there's no payoff.
Yeah, there's no payoff.
There's no payoff, because you could stop at year eight and you know, there it's done. Or you can just
Yeah.
keep going and follow that the voice of the muse and keep pursuing, and eventually you'll make it.
Yeah. I just really feel like I just couldn't let it go. And I knew whether the next day or 5 years or 10 years, I will always have that in the back of my mind. Like it would have haunted me for sure. And so like that's why like I just knew I had to keep going, like somehow.
And what did your parents think the entire time before the book came out?
I think they were just like, you know, worried. I mean, obviously, right? Like it was quite tumultuous in like my early 20s. And like, you know, when I went to coding boot camp, I think they were like relieved that I was like on like a new path that like potentially could be like more stable. But I didn't even tell them until like I signed a deal with like Simon Schuster and Atria. I was like, I have a book coming out. And but because like the process takes 2 years to publication, like they didn't really believe me, right? Because like they have to see it like a bookstore, like Barnes Noble, like physically hold it to like believe me. And you know, for like a long time, like I tell everybody this story because my dad truly thought I went to Kinko's and like printed out some like pages and like hot glued it together, right? Like they didn't like believe me. And then it's so funny, I told them I got Good Morning America and my mom was like, is that the Today Show? And like, you know, like they still didn't quite understand. But when I got into Muay Viet, that's when they understood. Yeah, there's like, oh, they're like, oh shit.
It got
Yeah.
real.
Yeah, they're like you?
You have a lot. Now it makes sense now. Again, like I said, you know, I felt like it was a 50-year-old woman who wrote the book, because there's so many settings. And but now I get it. Now you go back to Vietnam quite a bit. You lived in Seattle. There's all of these th pockets in of Hawaii, of OC. And yeah, one of my questions was, how did you get to know all these places and characters so well? Because when you're developing characters and scenarios, they have to react to certain things and have to have certain cues and certain understanding of like the locale that they're. So when you write about these things, I was like, oh, this woman has a lot of experience with living in all these places. And I think that's so important, because it gives you such a richer texture as a reader. You're like, oh, this is some real life shit.
I think I just really, whenever I travel, I like, maybe it's like my writer brain, but I like have like, I, so it's gonna sound a little crazy, so just stay with me. Like, I see my reality around me, but then I have these made up worlds in my head of where I am. And so I can just see like the storyline of Tao, who is the expat who moves back to Saigon, right? Like, that's a very real storyline. There's so many Vietnamese people who move back and start businesses. And like, there's, it's such a vibrant scene of like expats, right? But not just any expat, like the Vietnamese expat scene. And so I really wanted to like highlight that type of culture where like, you know, like they don't, Vietnam's like thriving, right? And so I really wanted to like show like what was happening over there, because not a lot of us know really, for especially for those who like who haven't been back or who have never been over there, you know, like you should go have fun, like drink a lot, you know? Yeah.
You sound like a lot of fun, Carolyn.
Yeah, go have fun, right? And so, and you know, the storyline about Hawaii, like I really want to make sure I do that justice. Like, I'm talking, you know, I want to make sure like I'm not, everybody go to Hawaii right now, everybody go see the psychic, you know, like that's not what, like flood the islands, like eat everything, clog the highways, you know, take everything. Like, that's definitely not what I want to do at all. And I just really want to highlight a very specific Vietnamese experience of that Vietnamese culture in Hawaii, because there is a lot of us over there, right? And so again, just sticking to the Vietnamese diaspora scene in each of these places, because that's the best I can speak to and not anything else.
Yeah, you know, I'm stuck on what you said. You know, without the risk of offending listeners and audience, it's, for me, I just find it mind-blowing for Vietnamese people in Orange County or Houston or San Jose or any enclave to have, God, this is such a bad thing to say, to have the means but not go to Vietnam for political reasons or whatever. That, yeah. And it holds you back because there is this thriving world in Vietnam, in Saigon, Hanoi, that 98 million people live in this country, and you're disconnected from this motherland. And how can we think that we are entirely American? You know, now fuck that. I'm American. I don't fuck with the other side. It's just the, but it's the cradle of where our culture comes from, and to deny that annually for me is a painful thing. It's painful for me not to even be living there.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of it stems from fear, right? And it's the same war propaganda, and like, it's like, I can't fault them because, you know, I didn't escape a war. You know, I just simply woke up one day and I'm like, oh, born in Fountain Valley, California. Like, look at me, right? Like, I don't know. I don't carry that type of like
that trauma.
But I do carry a different type of trauma, right? That was like passed down to me from my parents. And like, but you know, I just began to become so curious. And that curiosity is like what you see in the book of like, what's out there? And like, what's out there, like, actually be okay. And I remember the first time I went to visit Vietnam, I was like, holy, this is so fun. Like the scooters, the late nights, eating snails, drinking beer, like clams, shopping, like, you know, like it was just so
alive,
vibrant.
Alive,
yeah,
compared
it's so
to
vibrant.
Fountain Valley or even LA.
Yeah,
I come off the airplane coming up from Saigon for a few weeks. Every time I feel like I'm coming back to a sleepy town.
Yeah, right. And that's just like, that joy is what I really wanted to capture in the book, because you know, that same joy can we have it in the diaspora too.
Yeah.
You know,
you were just talking about how like when you travel, you know, you see things and you, there's imaginary sort of scenarios that you play out, you know, and that's one of my questions, because there is a lot of details happening in different places. You know, you jump it back and forth in the storylines from different locales, and there's details that I'm like, okay, when I'm reading this, I imagine that the writer had to, you know, is there a database, like a bank of details that you've kept and you filed away in some systematic way where you can drop back into and go, okay, here's that experience. I'm going to pull this and I'm going to write about this. And because it's just, there's just so many of them happening in different places, and it's such a rich, and now that I get to know you by talking to you, somebody who who's fairly young, you're in your 20s when you're kind of putting all this stuff together. Is there a way that you've collected these stories and kind of put them in a database collection somewhere? That was like one of my things when I was like reading it. I was like, it's not like a linear story or just, we're not dealing with one character or two characters that are the main storyline. We're dealing with like 14. It's like the Joylet Club, right? It's like, we're dealing with a big cast of characters that have a lot of stories. And I was wondering, how did you keep track of all these like little details?
I don't think I did very well. I still don't even, like, my mind is so bad where, like, I can't even remember all 14 characters sometimes, you know, because like it was so chaotic in my mind. I will say though, when I travel or when I come across an experience, I'm like, my God, this is so memorable. I do pull like one thing from that experience and I tuck it away in my mind, where like, for example, in the storyline about Hawaii, I mentioned zippies, right? There's a line about zippies where, you know, people are so full from zippies, and but they're still waiting for land, or they're still waiting for Hula to like come out. And like, but that's what happened to me, where like I grabbed a zippies breakfast platter and I was like chowing down. I was like, God, like, where is this woman? Right. And like, and so, but in my mind, I was like, why? That is the most Hawaiian thing I could do. I'm eating zippies and I'm waiting for a Vietnamese psychic.
It's very specific. Honolulu. And that's the kind of shit that I'm talking about. That's the kind of stuff that I picked up on. I was like, these are very specific things, and you got to have either a good memory or very creative or all of it to remember these very specific things that are happening to the characters. Because I mean, I wouldn't be able to remember. I try to think about that all the time. Like, you know, when I'm thinking creatively, but it's hard if you're not writing it down and putting it in some systematic way, but you're just recalling this out of your brain.
I'm just recalling. Yeah. And, you know, in my like official bio, I say, you know, I'm really interested in memory, both real and imaginary. And real and imaginary to me of memories is, you know, that's my right to play around with in my mind. Right. Because even though I'm eating zippies breakfast butter, waiting to see this Vietnamese psychic at 27, like that is real, but everything else around me can be imaginary. And that's where like how I like parse things or piece things together, you know? I don't know. My mind is just kind of jumbled. It's messy too. Don't listen to me. I don't know what I'm saying. I don't know. I really don't know how I wrote that book. I really don't know. I don't know. I don't know anything.
Tell us how you really feel.
It's like, I still look back, I'm like, how did that happen? You know, it's just so many characters, there's so many storylines, and it just all came out of me.
Do you see it? Do you see it as a movie one day?
I don't know if I'm allowed to say. Oh, wait, can you like, you can, never mind. Yeah, I do.
You don't have to answer if you're legally bound not to. It sounds like you have a deal in place. Because, you know, well, before you answer that, I could see it, because it's like the, you know, it didn't hit me right away, but after I finished it, I was like, as I was just doing my question, you know, research, to sit with you. Yeah. A lot of it reminded me of Joylet Club.
Yes. Yeah. I did pull inspiration from Joylet Club, where like she had all these multiple point of views of the women but not just the first generation, like the older generation, you know, like I've always loved that. And she's like the OG. That is like the OG, like staple that's, and for a long time, that's all we had.
Yeah,
That's
it
literally
really is.
all we had.
But this is a whole lot funnier than the Joy Luck Club.
It's a very Vietnamese story, right? Like, you know, people, I just think Vietnamese people are so funny, whether intentional or unintentional. I just think it's so funny.
Now, have your mom and dad or family, have they read the book?
They can't read it, but I think they have skimmed it. And I think my, she's like, listen, I think my mother was quite shocked because, oh wait, should I give away a spoiler? Well, I won't give away a spoiler, but like in the synopsis, it says like somebody dies. And I told her in the book who dies, and she was like aghast. She was like, why would you have that in the book? Because she's so superstitious, right? Yeah. And I was like, it's fiction. And she's like, but you wrote it into existence. I was like, no, it's fiction.
Yeah,
You know,
for
and stuff.
Vietnamese people, yeah. You can't
Yeah.
just talk
And
about death willy-nilly.
yeah. Yeah. And so she was quite like shocked because of the character who dies too.
What about friends and family? What's been their reception?
You know, I think I have been very silent about my writing dreams. You know, some people just disappear. We don't like really, because sometimes you just want to keep it to yourself. People have been very shocked and surprised. And when they read it, they're like, this book is so you. This book is so you. Like the humor, the storylines, everything, the women, and like the people who have known me and loved me and held me and fed me, they understand like this comes from me. Yeah, they can just see me all over it. And so that is like probably like my favorite type of reception so far.
What's next for you?
I am writing a story about a family set in Houston's Little Saigon, and I love Vietnamese Americans in Texas because they're like just like a bit rowdier and like funnier. But I'm writing about a family there, another family story, right? And it's like I'm calling it like House of Ho meets like Succession. So it's about like you know, my first story is about the mother and daughter's relationship. My second story is about the father and daughter relationship.
Oh, that sounds so interesting. But you're right. They're a different breed.
Very different.
Very
Yeah.
different.
There, yeah. Very different. And it's so funny because I was on book tour and I stopped in Houston and I was in conversation with Christine Ha from MasterChef. And Christine Ha was my partner in conversation. And you know, she was telling me in Houston they have their own Lanvo. Yeah, I think his name
Wow.
is Gojin. And we talked about how people line up to see this man. He used to be like a monk or something, I don't know. And like, but every community has their own Lanvo, their own psychic.
Wow, I gotta check him out too.
I'm about to buy a one-way ticket to go see this guy.
The thing about the Houston Vietnamese is they're I think they're very warm and they're strong, but they're warm and you're right, they're rowdier. They drink a lot and they party a lot. And you'd think Orange County people party and drink, but I think Houston people take it to the next level.
Only in Houston could they come up with Viet Cajun crawfish, right? Yeah. Right? That sounds like maybe we should all move to Houston. Yeah.
And then you have the East Coast Vietnamese that are just, quiet, just super hard charging, quiet, think before they speak.
I don't know. I met Jess Vu, so I don't know. She's from Philly. Hi, Jess.
Shout out to Jess. Yeah. I was born in the East Coast as well, not too far from where she grew up.
Okay. Are you also from Philly or?
No, I was just born in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And then my parents moved around for the first year of my life and settled in LA. Thank God, yeah. I grew up in Koreatown, heart of Koreatown.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
So do you wear a gold chain?
Do I wear? Kevin wins. All right, this is the other thing we're going to talk about. There's a lot of stereotypes that are beginning to come up, right? The Kevin wins, right? And we should talk about that. And then the newest one, it's not new, but it has been around now, is Juhai. Did you know about that? Juhai,
yes,
comes from the Supdoc kind of world. Shout out to Supdoc. So Juhai now, and then we have the Kevin wins. Is there any other ones?
Well, so the character of Andy, I just love Andy. He's like my type of like dream man. And actually my current partner is very much Andy. Yeah. Andy's like sweet, loves podcasts, walks around with socks on. He's like a sweet Vietnamese man. And my partner now is a sweet Vietnamese man. Very, socks, loves his podcasts, his musicals. He couldn't throw a fight like a fist in his life, and like that type of I didn't want to make these guys like caricatures because they don't come, they're not really part of the story, they're just kind of like there to add comic relief, or like they come in at the very end. I won't spoil the scene, but they are there as like a device to collide these storylines together. But the Kevin Nguyen's, I
say no more. I get it.
The Kevin Nguyen's, they're very special to me. Yes.
You know what I wanted to ask you? Do you think the Kevin Nguyen's know that they're Kevin Nguyen's?
No, they don't, which makes it funnier, right? I don't think they know. Or maybe they do know, but they don't want to say out loud. I don't know. But the Kevin Nguyen's are different in San Gabriel Valley and Cerritos and Orange County and Torrance. No, that is very different. And the Kevins are very different in each one. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Same as AVG. It's very different in each one. It's very specific, right? Yeah. West Coast Asian Vietnamese culture is so funny to me because like we all have our different pockets, of like the Cerritos Kevins or the Torrance Kevins, and like everyone's so different. But like I could only really just give a slice of life capture of like what the template of a Kevin Nguyen can be. Yes,
we should partner up and do a major ethnographic study on the Kevins of SoCal. That would complete like a fat.
That would be very funny. Yeah. Yeah. I would you and me team up, go podcast on the street. Yeah.
Or just say, well, the thing is, I have some, the reason I asked that is because I have been called a bro my entire life.
Oh, and I can see that. No, like I can see it. Yeah, not like in a bad way, but yeah, I can see it. Yeah,
and I think when I was younger, I was like, I didn't know what that meant, and that's why I'm asking you about the whole Kevin. Do you think Kevin Wins know what that? I didn't know that my close friends were being derogatory. I felt like for the longest time, my naive mind was like, oh, like a guy who works out, who wears baseball hats, and I'm always in a baseball hat. I thought it was a really cool thing, but it's not. It's like, it's not being.
No, you own it. You should own that. You should own that label.
I've grown out of it. I'm no longer happy. It doesn't sit well with me now.
Well, you can be, what was it? The Juhai or the yeah. Kevin Nguyen.
I've been called the Juhai many times now, but I'm okay with that. I'm pushing 50 here soon. So I'm like, all right, I'll take it. It's better. Juhai is better than being called a bro.
That's true.
Or a Kevin.
That Nguyen. Is true. You have upgraded it. My friends. Yes. You've upgraded in life.
Yeah. Well, Carolyn, thank you so much for spending this wonderful morning. It's a pleasure to get to know writers and the minds behind the creative work that they put out.
This was so fun. Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Like, it's, you know, I used to listen in on this podcast, so I can't believe it's like, here I am. Here I am, world. Yeah.
And we can't wait to see the many more years of the work that you do, and all of the future writers that you will help along the way and mentor. That's the beauty of, I think, being Vietnamese and being in this world of supporting each other and uplifting and amplifying each other's voice. It's just a beautiful thing. So thank you for coming on, and thank you for writing such a wonderful and entertaining book.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for doing this and uplifting Vietnamese voices. Yeah. And giving us a platform and bringing us together. We're just like, thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
All right, Carolyn, have a wonderful day.
Thank you so much. Okay. Okay. Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcasts.